submissions for really close to 20 years. I think maybe this is your 19 for me, popping into 20. I'll just briefly, 4.5 of that I spent in South Africa with Chi Alpha there, working with university students. And then whatever the math is, the rest of that, I've been in the States working with Chi Alpha. If you happen to not know what Chi Alpha is, it is the missions arm of the Assemblies of God to secular universities all around the world. And so that's where I've had the privilege actually to live life with Mackenzie for the last 4 years. And gosh, she's so great. I know you guys know that, but she is fantastic. And now she's decided to leave us. And we're very sad about it, but I hear we're getting Lauren in replacement, and so we're just pumped to keep the Maria family coming through Chi Alpha in Lafayette. But it really is my privilege and my honor to give my life living it with university students and just investing in their relationship with God. And so, man, what an honor it has been to live life in missions, but even more than that, to live life on mission. Before I jump deeply into that, anytime I speak places, I noticed this when I was younger. People would come and speak and they would share pictures of children. And somehow when you show pictures of kids, when you get ready to preach the word of God, I don't know, it makes you more credible. And so luckily I have these nieces and nephews, and my nieces and nephews call me Ran Ran. And so I always share a Ran Ran picture of the week, and somehow it helps my credibility, or I just think they're really cute and I force people to look at them. So on the left side here in the black suit is my oldest nephew, Joseph Amos. He's 13, and he went to his first little middle school dance a few weeks ago. And here's what I tell our students when I talk about Joseph. I'm like, look, you guys may not think I'm cool, but I've got a 13-year-old nephew that thinks I'm really cool. And if you know anything about 13-year-old boys, they're real iffy and they're very harsh critics. And so the fact that he thinks I'm cool, I am probably the coolest person you're ever gonna meet because my nephew thinks I'm just really cool. I was in their house last summer. They live in Kansas City. My oldest brother and his four kids live in Kansas City, Missouri. I went to visit, and at some point, Joseph was like, Ran, Ran, you should just live with us. And I was like, well, bud, I have a job, and I got things to do in Lafayette. And he was like, it's fine. You don't need a job. Just come live with us. And I was like, I don't know if you've discussed that with your dad, because I'm pretty sure my brother's goal in life is not to support his adult sister for no reason whatsoever. But he thinks I'm cool, so I'm throwing that out there in case you were doubting me. Super cool, based off of my 13-year-old nephew. And then I also like to share my pictures of Rufus Henry. Rufus Henry is my dog, and I just think he's adorable. So these pictures were from our Mardi Gras trip back in February. You guys actually hosted some of our students here in Gina for Mardi Gras. I took a group of students to San Antonio, and Rufus Henry got to go on his very first Mardi Gras trip with me. He's almost 7, but this was the first time that I was able to take him, and this guy had a blast. I'll tell you more about it in a little bit, but he had a great time. And he's just my favorite. During finals week, I will be doing a meet and greet for Rufus Henry with students because he's like a little celebrity on campus now. And so our students are like, when am I going to meet Rufus? Why don't you bring him to the office? And I'm like, well, this is my place of work. And we have a coffee shop, so like health code violations. I was like, but no worries, friends. We'll put it in the email. You can meet Rufus during finals week, and it's going to be wonderful. He's got this whole little following at this point. He's a good time. He's such a good guy. Oh, I love him a lot. Anyway, I also love living on mission. We're going to transition back to the word here. I love living in missions, but also life on mission. If you've heard me speak before, I often talk about how I think we get a misinterpretation about missions. And so often we think missions is reserved for those like myself that have the privilege of it being full-time. For 20 years, that's been my job, is to travel the world and to live life with university students, to teach them about Jesus and help them grow in their relationship. I count it an absolute privilege. But here's the deal. I'm not the only one called to missions. If we've given our life to Jesus, we're all called to missions. My mission field gets to be, at this point, the University of Louisiana and the nearly 20,000 students that are walking that campus. And man, more and more, I'm convinced they need to know Jesus. But for you guys, if you're living here, your mission field is Gina. If you don't know it, let me explain this morning, you are also missionaries. You're missionaries currently in this season called to Gina, Louisiana, to bring the gospel and to help people know Jesus and to grow in relationship with him. I think as believers, we're all called to missions and to live life on mission. There's a passage in Philippians. Philippians is written by the Apostle Paul. I preached a leadership retreat last weekend with our students. We run a class every spring called Discipleship Training Class. We teach students to be disciples who make disciples, who make disciples who will keep making disciples for the rest of their lives. And so I kicked off our DTC retreat last weekend, and I shared over the life of Joseph from the Old Testament. And so I was telling our students, man, I think possibly in the Old Testament, Joseph's life is the most challenging for me. If you don't know the story of Joseph, it's wild. Go read it. The back end of Genesis, starting in chapter 37. It just deeply convicts me and challenges me. But I think in the New Testament, other than Jesus, the life that challenges me the most is the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul, we're going to read in chapter 2, but later in Philippians in chapter 4 is where we see Paul talk about, I know what it is to be content, whether I have plenty or I have need, to live in freedom or to live in prison. And Paul meant that. If you don't know Paul's life, Paul laid down his life for the gospel, very literally. He eventually was martyred for his faith. But Paul is writing those words, and he's not writing those words. Sometimes we like to talk about it, and we're like, I know what it is to be content. Friends, I've never been in prison, and hopefully I never wind up there. And I've for sure never been in prison for my faith. The Lord has provided, I would say, more than abundantly in my life. Paul wrote from a place of experience, though. Paul wasn't writing from a place of theory. Paul was writing from a place of, he had lived life in abundance, but he had also lived life in prison. He had lived life free, but he also lived his life shipwrecked and bitten by snakes and beaten for his faith. And Paul continued to proclaim the gospel. And Paul continued to live his life on mission. The life of Paul challenges and convicts me. And not just because of my vocation, but because of my proclamation of Jesus. I am a believer in Jesus, therefore, I think we're called to live the same way that Paul did. Again, maybe it's not your job, but I think it's the calling on all of our lives as believers. And so Philippians chapter 2, let's read together verses 19 through 30. That sounds like a lot, but it goes really quick. So here we go, starting in verse 19. It says, I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon, that I may also be cheered when I receive news about you. I have no one else like him who will show genuine concern for your welfare, for everyone looks out for their own interests, but not those of Jesus Christ. But you know that Timothy has proved himself because as a son with a father, he has served with me in the work of the gospel. I hope therefore to send him as soon as I see how things go with me, and I am confident in the Lord that I myself will come soon. But I think it's necessary to send back to you Epaphroditus, what a name, my brother, co-worker, and fellow soldier, who is also your messenger, whom you sent to take care of my needs. For he longs for all of you and is distressed because you heard he was ill. Indeed, he was ill and almost died, but God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but also on me, to spare me sorrow upon sorrow. Therefore, I am all the more eager to send him, so that when you see him again, you may be glad and I may have less anxiety. So then welcome him in the Lord with great joy and honor people like him, because he almost died for the work of Christ. He risked his life to make up for the help you yourselves could not give me. So here's Paul in the book of Philippians. He's writing this letter to the church at Philippi. He's in prison at this point. He's writing this letter from prison, and he's affirming people, and he's speaking life, and he's also challenging. When I read that passage in chapter 2, I think it is the epitome, or it's a great example of what it means to live life on mission. I think if we're going to live life on mission as believers, which is what I think we're called to, there's three principles or three actions that we can pull out of this short passage that challenges us of how we should be living our life on mission. The first thing that we need to be doing if we're going to live our life on mission is that we're showing actual concern for the welfare of others. He's talking about Timothy, and he's like, man, my guy Timothy, which I don't, if Paul was affirming me, let me just say, I would feel even better about myself than my 13-year-old nephew loving me, right? Because this is the Apostle Paul. And he's like, this is a guy that I think is getting it right. And he's like, hey, Timothy, this guy Timothy, he's living it out. And Timothy's got a genuine concern for the welfare of other people. Friends, if we're going to live life on mission, we got to have a genuine concern for the welfare of others. We can't just be concerned about ourselves and our families, but we've got to be concerned about everyone that is around us, and it's got to be a genuine concern that we have for people. In the book of Matthew, chapter 25, in verses 34 through 40, It says, "Then the king will say to those on his right, 'Come, you who are blessed by my father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me.' Then the righteous will answer him, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothing and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?' The king will reply, 'Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters, you did for me.'" When we have a genuine concern for others, we're not just ministering and taking care of others, we're ministering to the Lord. How many times have we ministered to the Lord simply because we saw our neighbors and we met a need? If we wait until it looks like we're giving to the Lord in order to give, if we wait until it looks like this big, massive thing before we're willing to do it, then we don't have a genuine concern for others. During Mardi Gras, I mentioned I took Rufus and a group of students to San Antonio, but you guys hosted a group of our students. So during Mardi Gras, our students get time off. Our university students get time off. Actually, all of South Louisiana gets time off. This baffles me still. Do your public schools, like your high schools, get time off here for Mardi Gras? Yes? No. Okay. Some are saying yes, some are saying no. I'm not sure. I grew up in North Louisiana. I actually grew up in Ruston, graduated from Louisiana Tech. As a like elementary and university or elementary and high school student, we didn't get time off for Mardi Gras. It wasn't until I was in Louisiana Tech. South Louisiana, everybody, it just shuts down. We decided as a ministry years and years ago, what better way to redeem this break than to encourage our students to go on mission, a short little mission trip of sorts. And so predominantly we send teams to partner with Chi Alpha groups in neighboring states. But then a couple years ago, we were like, ooh, what if we partnered with some of our AG churches in the state and send some students to love on some communities and some churches? And so you guys hosted a group of our students. I mentioned to, I think it was Kaylin the other day, I was like, oh, I'm going to Gina this weekend. And she was like, I love Gina because she came and spent Mardi Gras with you guys. And here's the thing, I think there's a picture maybe or a couple of pictures. I think you guys are looking out for the welfare of others, genuinely. There's a church that you've been loving on that burned down in, is it Vidalia? In Vidalia. That doesn't benefit you. That's not a part of your welfare, but it's a genuine welfare that you have for others, and you're living out life on mission by partnering with them. Our students loved getting to be a part of that. They loved getting to see the way that churches are being the church in communities, even communities beyond their immediate reach. They also had the chance to serve, I think it was in some widows' yards here in the community in Gina, and they loved it because they're getting to see in action, you guys are doing exactly what Paul's challenging us to do, live on mission. Can I encourage you guys? You're doing it, but keep doing it. And I would encourage you, do it even more. You've been loving people, love even more people. I don't know, go find you some more people. I don't know where you find them, but go find you some more people so that you can genuinely love them and have a genuine concern. I think it's what we're called to do as believers. We're called to live on mission. And the first way that we see it there in Philippians is by having a genuine concern for the welfare of others. Well done, LifePoint, doing that. But it doesn't stop with what you've done. It should continue to grow beyond what you've even been investing in. The second thing that I think we see with Paul there is that we have to be looking out for the interest of Jesus. He addresses the fact that most people are looking out for the interest of themselves. But then he says, man, Timothy's looking out for the interest of Jesus. What is the interest of Jesus? That's a great question. I'm glad you asked. What is the interest of Jesus that we need to be looking out for? Let's look at 2 Peter. 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 and 9 says, "But do not forget this one thing, dear friends. With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like a day. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promises, as some understand slowness. Instead, he is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance." The interest of Jesus is everyone. The interest of Jesus is every single soul that the Lord has created. It doesn't matter who they are the interest of Jesus. And the interest is that they would step into life-saving relationship with him so that they're able to spend eternity with him. The interest of Jesus is that everyone have the opportunity to hear the gospel and to come to know him and to live out relationship with him. Friends, can I ask you, if you're living on mission, how are you at the interest of Jesus? Are you interested in people's souls? Or even, we can't just even be interested in church. I'm so sorry. I don't mean that to sound offensive, but if all we're interested in is the interest of Life Point, and we're not interested in the interest of Jesus, which is the salvation of everyone, then we've gotten things skewed a little bit. We've got to have a genuine welfare or a genuine concern for the welfare of others, but we've got to have an interest in the things of Jesus. I bought a house almost 3 years ago. July will be 3 years. And so Rufus and I walk our neighborhood every day. And here's the thing. I think Rufus Henry is the smartest dog that has ever lived. I'm a little bit biased. I'll just go ahead and acknowledge that. But gosh, this dude's smart. My old neighborhood, the first, I guess, I don't know, 15 years that I lived in Lafayette, I lived right next to campus. And then I lived right next to the edge of downtown, which is all really close proximity in Lafayette. And so I lived in really dense areas. And so when I got Rufus Henry, we didn't walk a lot. My neighborhood was very congested, right on the edge of downtown. There's tons of people everywhere. There's tons of students everywhere. So it was a great spot to live, not a great spot to walk a dog. However, we moved into this new neighborhood, and we're in a very quiet area of Lafayette. We're near the, the airport? We're near the airport. It's an old established neighborhood. It's kind of tucked away. I didn't even know it existed until I started looking for houses. And so then Rufus Henry and I started walking a little more because our neighborhood is really conducive to that. And then here's why I say he's really smart. This dude has caught on, and now he's demanding, and he demands a walk every day. And initially I was like, man, bud, you just ate dinner. Like, there's no way you need to potty again. But he's making laps, like little circles by the front door. And I was like, there's no shot you need to potty. And then I realized he's not trying to tell me he wants to potty. He's trying to tell me it's time to go for a walk. So now Rufus and I walk about a mile and a half every day in our neighborhood. And now we've become friends with the neighbors. Last night I stood in a neighbor's yard for a long time and chatted because there's some foxes that live in our neighborhood. That's a different story. I have way too many pictures on my phone. I'll show you after. They're so fascinating. But I stood and talked to this one neighbor for a long time. There's this other neighbor that lives on a corner, and I think he's living the dream. His friends come over and hang out in the driveway with him every afternoon. And so Mr. Rodney and his little friends, and they all talk to me, and they say hi, and they talk about Rufus. And then a couple streets over is another neighbor named Catherine. And so I've stopped and chatted with Catherine a few times. Back in the fall, I'm running one day. And here's the deal, I don't run with Rufus. Rufus is way too fast for me. He's got too many legs. And so he's fast, but he's big and he's strong. So like, can't run with Rufus. I walk Rufus and then I will go run. And so I'm running the neighborhood one day, Catherine's in her yard and she stops me. So I pull my headphones out and she's like, where's your dog? And I was like, oh, I already walked him. I can't run with him. I run alone. I run for me, I walk for him. And now we start chit-chatting and she starts talking about how she's having a crisis of faith. And by the end of the time standing in the yard with this neighbor that I've now befriended, who Jesus has an interest in, I'm able to start praying for. I bake bread. And so for Christmas, I made bread for a few of the neighbors. I go drop a loaf off at Mr. Rodney's house. I chat with him and his son for a bit. And then I swing by Catherine's. I drop off a loaf. And then Catherine messages me the next day and was like, hey, I have a pie for you. And I'm like, ooh, my bread has turned into pie. This is a good plan. And I was like, well, hey, why don't I come by and we'll drink some coffee and eat some pie together. And so I go by Catherine's house and she fixes coffee and maybe one of the best pecan pies I've ever had in my life. So I'm like, note to self, make more bread for Catherine. Or maybe make less bread for Catherine because I don't need that pie, but it's so good. So I sit down and I'm having this conversation with Catherine. We're drinking coffee, we're eating pie. And I've been curious and she's mentioned things about this crisis of faith and she's having a hard time. And so then just casually, she moved into the neighborhood after me. I know this. So then I asked, and I was like, well, Catherine, where were you before you were living in this house? And then she begins to explain to me that she was living with a woman who she had been in a 20-year relationship with. And this woman is all of a sudden realizing she's not living right before God. She's concerned about her eternal destination, breaks things off with Catherine. Catherine doesn't feel the same way, and she's in this just crisis of faith and spinning and questioning everything in her life. And so I keep building relationship with Catherine now, and I speak a little bit into it, but I don't quite have the relationship yet to really go for it, but she knows who I am and what I believe. And so now she's in a kitchen renovation, and I'm paying attention as we walk by, because as soon as the trailer leaves, I know it means the kitchen's done, which means I can ask to come see it. And then I can continue building a relationship with Catherine to be able to invite her to my church, to be able to share more of the words of Jesus with her. Why? because I'm concerned with her welfare, but I'm concerned with the interest of Jesus. And Catherine is of interest to Jesus. Our students during Mardi Gras, I was in San Antonio, some were here, some went to Corpus Christi. There's a campus, I think it's Texas A&M University, Corpus Christi, that's in Corpus Christi. And so we sent a small group of students to Corpus Christi. And so they come back and they're telling stories, and I think there were six of them. Yeah, they were a small little crew this time that went to Corpus. And they come back and they're telling me stories from their time on campus. So the way our teams normally work, the weekend we'll do some kind of manual labor somewhere, and then during the week we're on campus, and we do what we call two-by-twos. And so we get that from when Jesus sent the disciples out two by two, in pairs of two. So we'll go out in pairs of two on campus, and we're just looking for folks to tell about Jesus. And so these students go out, and two of them, I don't remember which two it was, but two of them go out, and they meet a student. And I can't remember his name, so we're just going to call him Bob. It wasn't Bob, but we'll call him Bob. And so they go out, and they meet Bob, and Bob has questions about Jesus and Christianity. And so they just randomly encounter Bob. They answer some of Bob's questions. They then go about with their time. The next day, a different two of our students go out, and do you know who they met on a campus? A campus of thousands upon thousands. I got six kids on this campus of thousands, and who did they meet? Bob. They met Bob. Do you know why they met Bob? Because Jesus is interested in Bob. And Jesus is fighting for Bob. And so Jesus is using my students, my sweet six little students that have given up their Mardi Gras break to go on campus, and Jesus is using them to meet Bob and to bring Bob into the kingdom. Man, how crazy is that? I don't do the maths, but if you did the math and like the probability of my six students on a campus of thousands running into the exact same student in a short time frame, six students that don't even go to that campus, and here they are for just a couple of days and they run into the same kid. And so my second two students begin to share about Jesus with Bob. They begin to speak life into Bob. They invite Bob to Chi Alpha, and Bob is on a journey of growing in and deepening a relationship with God now. Man, because Jesus is interested in who? Everyone. If we're really going to live life on mission, which is what we're called to do, then we have to be genuinely concerned about the welfare of others. We have to genuinely have an interest in the interest of Jesus. And then lastly, we need to share in the work of the gospel. I don't think sharing the gospel is relegated just for those of us that hold credentials or those of us that are in vocation. It's not just PJ's job to share the gospel. But if you've heard the gospel, if you've received the gospel, you are now commissioned to share the gospel. And what I mean by that is you're just commissioned to share the good news of who Jesus is. That's the gospel. It means good news. If you know Jesus, you are commissioned to tell people about Jesus. You're not just commissioned. Actually, you're mandated to tell people about Jesus. Once we've accepted him, that's the only mandate. Well, there's ways that we should be living, but then we're mandated to then take that good news and share it with others and invite them into the kingdom as well. We find that in Matthew chapter 28. Matthew chapter 28, we refer to this passage as the Great Commission. I like to tell people it's not called the Great Suggestion. It's not called the Great, here's a little bit of information what you could be doing. It's called the Great Commission. We are commissioned as believers to go forth and to share the gospel with others. Matthew 28, verses 19 and 20. It says, therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. He's telling that to all of us. Hey, friends, you now have permission. You have been commissioned as believers to take the good news and to go forth and to share that with others. What an exciting thing. If we've given our life to Jesus, it means we have the eternal saving knowledge that we can share with others. There was an old magician pair, I don't know what you call it, not couple, they weren't a couple, but like duo, we'll go with that, Penn and Teller. And there was an interview one time with one of them, I'm going to butcher this, but there was an interview with one of them. He was a vocal atheist, so did not believe in God, did not believe in any of the things that we believe in. But he's in an interview one time, and he made the statement that, man, for believers, for Christians, if you really think that people are wandering off to hell without giving their lives to Jesus, then you must really hate people to not tell them about Jesus. Like, if that's really what we believe, that people are going to hell without walking into relationship with Jesus, that's the only way to get into heaven, to be with the Father, is to give your life to Jesus. If we really believe that, and we have the ability to share that with others, then how much must we dislike people or hate them to have that knowledge and to not tell people? And for someone who doesn't even believe to see that and to acknowledge that, can I challenge you this morning that we need to be sharing in the work of the gospel? We need to be proclaiming the words of Jesus to others because it is the only thing that will save us. It is the only thing that will change lives. It is the only thing that brings us right before the Father. In the book of Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 6, verses 8 and 9, it says, "Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send and whom will go for us?' And I said, 'Here I am, send me.' He said, 'Go and tell this people, go and tell this people, be ever hearing but never understanding, be ever seeing, never perceiving.'" I love the fact that God's saying, "Who's going to go?" And Isaiah says, "Hey, send me, send me, I'll go." I remember being a student at Louisiana Tech. I grew up in a Christian home. I feel like I had a great relationship walking into college, great relationship with God walking into college. But there was something about being involved with a community of my peers on a secular campus that just radically shifted things for me. And it ultimately changed even the trajectory of my life and what I'm doing with my life. And I remember, I think it was around my sophomore year at Louisiana Tech, I just felt like the Lord said, "Miranda, the way this has radically changed your life, will you give your life to do that for others?" And my response, "Ooh, send me. Ooh, pick me." Honestly, I'm like, that just sounds like a whole lot of fun. And it has been. I'm not saying it hasn't been hard or it hasn't had its challenges, but has it been worth it? 100%. That's where I feel like it's been the privilege to be a vocational missionary. But again, friends, we're all called to be missionaries. We're all called to be living life on mission. Will you respond to serving in the work of the gospel with "send me"? Send me to my job, send me to my neighborhood, send me to my family, send me to Walmart or wherever it may be, and Lord, give me the opportunities to work in the gospel alongside of you. For my Mardi Gras trip, I took students and Rufus Henry to San Antonio. Some dear friends of mine, Johnny and Amy Houck, are the campus directors there. And so Johnny calls me at some point as we're prepping for things, and he goes, "Hey, before we get into San Antonio, would you guys meet me at this campground for the weekend and we'll serve there?" I said, "Yeah, sure, man, whatever you need, we'll help, we're in." And so we're in the middle of nowhere in Texas. I was trying to explain this to somebody the other day. I was like, I don't know, like an hour before San Antonio, you get off the interstate and you go north and you wander in the woods and there you are. And so we stop at this little bitty town in the middle of nowhere, get our grocery order, and then we get into this campground. And normally the way these teams work is you get in on Friday, you get your groceries, you get settled, you hang out, and then you get to work on Saturday morning. And so I'm assuming this is what we're gonna do. And so we get in, and we get in around 4:30, and I'm like, cool, we've beat all the wild Houston traffic, having to get through there. We've got our groceries. I'm like, I bought stuff for s'mores. We're gonna have a cute little fun night at this campground. It's gonna be great, and then we'll get to work Saturday morning. We pull into this campground, and Johnny is standing in like the dirt driveway. He points me where to park. I park. By the time I can get out of my car, Johnny has opened the back door, set Rufus free, and now I'm standing in this driveway. Like a couple minutes later, I get myself out. I'm standing in the driveway talking to Johnny, and I mean, by the time I can even get my bearings, Rufus Henry is in the pond, which is where he spent the next 3 days, living his absolute best life. I mean, you want to talk who had the best Mardi Gras trip? It was Rufus Henry. So Rufus Henry lives his life in the pond for the next 3 days. I'm standing there with Johnny, and he goes, "All right, cool. Well, let's walk up here. You can drop your bags, and we'll get to work." I was like, "I'm sorry, what?" And that's when I knew this is about to get wild. Like, I wasn't prepared for this, so like, we drop our bags real quick, we change clothes. Most of the weekend, we spent on a dock that was about 15 feet above the water, and we're ripping off the whole top layer. And when I say ripping off, I'm talking, we've got saws and crowbars, and then like hammers to knock the crowbar under. Like literally, we are prying boards off of this dock so that they can resurface it. We did some pressure washing, some weed eating. We burned who knows how many tons of debris and things. And then at some point, a couple of students and I built a bridge to another little island that's out in this campground. And so we worked hard. I will say, I think that's the tiredest I have come home from a Mardi Gras trip in the entirety of my time frame. We ran wide open the entire time. Normally during these Mardi Gras trips, you take your students, like you work hard, you do work hard, but then like, I don't, you get some downtime and you go to a cute coffee shop and maybe you see the scenes, if there's some scenes to see. We never saw a coffee shop or scenes. Like the best that I could offer my kids was we stopped at Bucky's 3 times. And I hate Bucky's. So this was the way that I loved my kids. I was like, I will let you go to Bucky's. And then finally on the way home, it was our third Bucky's stop. And I was like, no more. We will not see another Bucky's. We are going home now, friends. But we worked incredibly hard. The Saturday, there's a storm starting to roll in. And so at some point, I'm standing on the dock with Johnny. We're looking at a radar, like we're meteorologists or something. But we're looking at the radar, and I was like, I think it's going to miss us, man. And he's like, okay, yeah, I think so too. Let's start painting. And we're painting the diving platform that's on top of the dock. So again, our dock is like 10, 15 feet off of the water. And now there's a platform that goes up another 10 to 12 feet. And it's metal, and it needs to get painted. And you paint it with an epoxy paint, which means you mix two parts together. And once it's mixed, you have to use it. Like, that's it. And it's really expensive. So we're like judging all the weather. We're like, yeah, we can do it. So we mix this paint, and we're not meteorologists. And probably within, 30 minutes, the front fully blows through. And it's one of those that it gets eerily dark. I mean, it's like 3 in the afternoon. It's dark. And then you look up and you're like, that looks very ominous and not okay. And then the temperature starts to drop. The wind kicks up, and I don't know, it's like 10 or 15 degrees cooler in like 10 minutes. And I'm like, we made mistakes, man. But we've mixed this paint. And I walk off the dock for something, and I come back, and I've got 3 students left on the dock. The others are doing other stuff or kind of starting to hide. But I got these 3 kids that are left on the dock, and I walk up, and poor Gabe. Gabe's got a paintbrush in one hand and an umbrella in the other, and he's just shivering. And he's shivering, and he's trying to get it done. And then Amari is up the steps on the platform, and she's got her shirt over the back of her head, and she's painting, and she's like, it just hurts. Because you know when the rain's cold, and then it's super windy, and they're like the fat raindrops, and it hurts? And then I got poor Allison. Allison's on the top of the platform. She's shivering, and she's shaking, and she's shaking because she's afraid of heights. And homegirl is now 20-something feet, maybe 30 feet off of the water in the air, and she's painting. And I mean, I was like, come on, friends, we can do it. And so we do it until like we're out of paint, but like we're just pushing to get it done. Sunday, we get up. We think we're mostly done. We're not remotely done with anything. The next thing I know, Johnny's like, hey, I'm going to bring this load of wood over to this other part, and you grab that saw and that drill, and I'm going to get you to build this bridge, which I am a pretty handy person. I own power tools, and he knows that. So it's not like he's just like, hey, friends, here's some power tools. But he takes me over to this other side. He drives the little forklifty excavator through the woods. And my little kid, Matthew, I say little kid, he's not little, he's graduating in a couple of weeks. But Matthew, sweet, sweet Matthew. Matthew's in hospitality with Mackenzie, which means Matthew's not a woodsy guy in the least. Matthew's not a build bridges guy. Matthew's not really a hang off the side of the forklift excavator and drive through the woods kind of guy. But that's what Matthew does. And so now Matthew is on the other side of this little island with me. We start laying the decking on this bridge. I'm cutting things, I'm screwing things down. And Matthew's like, Johnny made me ride on the side of the thing through the woods. And he's a little distraught by it. I think it's the first experience of this kind of thing ever for Matthew. And at some point, it's me, Matthew, and Emma, we're building this bridge. And at some point, we would, you know, encounter something. Like, I got a wood chip that flies at me in the face. And we were like, for the gospel. And then we get really dramatic about it, you know, and something would happen. And we're, like, super tired. And we're like, for the gospel. And we're kind of just, it's a coping mechanism. But here's the thing. These kids, maybe the best team I've ever taken somewhere. It was wild, felt a little unhinged. At some point, my kids realized Johnny is just making this up as we go. We thought we had a plan, but we are flying by the seat of our pants, and we're not stopping. We get into San Antonio on Monday. I'm going in to lead their staff meeting. We park at the Chi Alpha house, and then Johnny goes, okay, everybody come over here. We walk out into the street. And he begins to explain to my kids how if you walk a couple blocks down, there's an apartment complex, and at the apartment complex, you can find a shuttle. And then just take that shuttle to campus, and just go tell some kids about Jesus. Literally, this is what my students are told. And I was like, all right, friends, best of luck. I've got a lead staff meeting now. I'm like, this is just what we're doing. And I sit with my kids on the Wednesday morning. We're eating breakfast before we come back. And I was like, I need you guys to know, I don't think I heard a complaint out of anybody the whole time. And then they tell me, they were like, there was one time Johnny left us and we didn't know what to do and we didn't know if he was coming back and we started complaining, but then we decided it had to be a positive negative sandwich if we were going to complain. So which means they would say a positive, they're one negative, and then another positive. And I'm like, you guys are killing it out here. And then I began to explain. I was like, look, I know we joked a lot about for the gospel. I was like, but here's the deal. Everything we do should be for the gospel. We ripped apart a dock so that a new dock can get laid. We built a bridge. We did all sorts of crazy manual labor legitimately for the gospel. Because what's going to happen is there's going to be kids, there's going to be students that are at this camp this summer, and they're going to be having such a good time playing on the dock, and then they're going to hear the gospel presentation and their eternity is going to be changed. There's going to be students that at some point from the University of San Antonio are going to realize, man, I stepped into a relationship with Jesus because there were some random Louisiana kids that were really lost, and then they began to tell me about Jesus. There's going to be students, or there's going to be people, or there are going to be families that their eternities are impacted because of the work that we did on this Mardi Gras trip in San Antonio and in wherever we were in Texas. We joked about it, but it became this mantra for my students, for the gospel. We're driving home and there's a guy named Gabe that was shivering with the paintbrush and the umbrella, and Gabe's in the front seat of my car. And he's just asking me questions about life and, you know, different things. And somehow it comes out. I was like, here's the deal, Gabe. My job is chaotic. My job is a lot of loud events, big events, loud things, just absolute chaos. I was like, personally, in my personality, that's not who I am. In my personality, I love my quiet corner of Lafayette. I love to be home. I love to not even talk to people, actually. Like, I don't love festivals. There's a giant festival in Lafayette this weekend. Hate it. Like, I want no part of it. I'm not a big crowd, loud music person. But so much of my job is that way. And I'm like, therefore, I embrace it for the gospel. I can do anything for the gospel. I don't have to like it, but I'll do it for the gospel. Do I want to sleep in a twin-size bunk bed in a campground in Texas and work until like I am just absolutely exhausted? Not necessarily, but for the gospel. Friends, I think we're called to live on mission. If you have given your life to Jesus, I think you are called to live life on mission. It doesn't matter what your vocation is. I think you're called to live life on mission. And so I want to ask you this morning, again, do you have a genuine concern for the welfare of others? Are you living out the way that Timothy did? And Paul is just applauding it, essentially, that he had a genuine concern for others. Are you looking out for the interest of Jesus? Which, again, the interest of Jesus is people. It's everybody. It's your family. It's your neighbors. It's the people at the grocery store. Are you looking out for the interest of Jesus by looking out for others? And then lastly, are you sharing in the work of the gospel? Are you sharing your faith? Maybe you're timid in that. Maybe that feels scary of like, I haven't read the Bible cover to cover. You know how you can start? Just invite them to church. PJ will do the hard part. He'll share the gospel with them. You just got to get them here. Get them here on a Sunday morning, a Sunday night, a Wednesday night. It doesn't matter. Get them somewhere that the gospel is being shared. And then I would challenge you to work on it for yourself. Practice with your friends then even, of sharing the gospel with them, of explaining who Jesus is and the need for him. But friends, I want to challenge you this morning. I think you're doing a great job. I think LifePoint is doing well when it comes to living on mission. You're even investing in missions all around the world. You guys are a part of what we're doing at the University of Louisiana. Thank you for that. But I also think we can always be growing in the way that we live on mission. And we have to do that individually because that's what we're called to do. Regardless of vocation, we are called to live on mission.